This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We're really at the very beginning, kind of 100 years ago, what a windmill is and what a wind farm is today. Same technology, just clearly optimized with new materials and higher efficiency.
By now, you may have heard about the arrest of 30 activists in the Arctic by the Russian government. Well, this week on Sea Change Radio, we hear the harrowing tale from a Greenpeace colleague of the imprisoned group that has become known as the Arctic 30. Then I speak to Gareth McKinley, an MIT professor whose students have come up with a potential solution for the rainless days that await many regions as climate change takes hold, a technology that effectively converts fog into potable water. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Keeler McDuff. She's a media officer for Greenpeace's Arctic campaign in the U.S. Keeler, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a brief snapshot, just for our listeners who are not familiar with the Greenpeace Arctic 30? Who are they and what has happened to them?
Thanks, Alex. The Arctic 30 are 28 volunteers, ship's crew, and activists from Greenpeace, and two independent freelance journalists who were seized by Russian commandos at sea about 6 weeks ago in what we believe to have been an illegal seizure. They were then taken to Russia and have since been charged with initially piracy and now hooliganism, both of which are very serious charges that carry custodially up to around 22 years in prison together. We had expected the piracy charges to be dropped as per the Russians about 2 weeks ago. That has not happened. So at the moment, they're all facing two sets of very serious and we believe baseless charges.
So walk us back to how they got into this pickle.
On September the 18th, we had our icebreaker, the Arctic Sunrise, up in the Russian Arctic doing a tour to really bring attention to the sort of environmental catastrophe that's happening in the Arctic. You know, your listeners will remember, of course, the debacle in the American Arctic last year when Shell, the self-proclaimed best of the best, one of the largest companies in the world, really put their foot very firmly into a pretty disastrous attempt on drilling up there. And since then, a lot of focus has switched to the Russian Arctic, where it's obviously there's not nearly as much scrutiny, there's not as much regulation. In fact, there's very little regulation. There's not really a free media, and there's also not as many environmental groups. So for both Russian companies, and we're seeing much more now for Western European and American companies, the Russian Arctic is where the next gold rush is going to be. And one of those enormous companies, Gazprom, which is majority Russian state-owned, has been for several years now proclaiming that this one particular platform they have is going to be the first working, functioning oil drill in the Arctic anywhere in the world. Unfortunately, the platform they're using is a nasty old rust bucket, and they've had a lot of problems with it, and so each year it's on hold because they have to do more repairs and they have to fix it up. We went up there, and in fact we also went there in 2012 and did a similar protest to highlight not only the terrible irony of increased extreme oil drilling that's allowed to happen now because so much of the ice has melted due to climate change, which of course is leading these organizations to drill more in order to cause more climate change, but also the incredible amount of spills. Russia is actually the second biggest, or maybe the first biggest, but the US is gaining fast, oil and gas producer in the world, and they are, tragically as well, one of the biggest oil polluters in the world. There's the equivalent of about 8 times the Deepwater Horizon disaster every year in Russia, both on land and in the ocean. The idea was that a couple of our activists would get in the little inflatable boats, we call them ribs, and they would head out to this platform, and some of them would scale the side of it and hang a banner to draw attention to this problem. what happened after that was pretty amazing. And there are several videos, both our videos and even the Russian Secret Service video that you can see on the internet. I think it's pretty breathtaking. We had multiple inflatables full of balaclavaed masked men wielding handguns and rifles and very big, very scary looking knives, sort of hunting knives or something, who approached the climbers. They started firing into the water, which I'm not quite sure, other than to terrify people. Our guys obviously immediately put their hands up. In the meantime, the ship they were on fired across the bow of the Arctic Sunrise 13 times with their cannon.
Why were they up in this Arctic region all armed and ready to go? They must have had some kind of a tip from somebody about this protest.
Because we'd been in the Arctic by then, I think, I forget exactly, I believe about a week and a half. We also know that Gazprom contacted them. This is the translation I have read, because we heard it over our radio, pretty directly said, like, come and get them, they're here, and then instructed them to arrest us, and then instructed them to at least get one of us. This, of course, is a private company who now has apparently a state-funded armed security squad. So you're right. I mean, definitely the company directly told them about it, and they had been watching us. You know, we knew that they were watching us and had been following us at some distance for days and days and days. What happened eventually happened on that day was that they started yanking, and again, you can see it in some of these videos. It's quite distressing. They started yanking on one of the woman's climbing ropes. And she's trying to tell them to stop. Everyone is trying to tell them to stop. But at the same time, they have everyone, you know, at the point of a gun. The people are trying not to get to escalate the situation at all. But it's very dangerous because she could have fallen or got caught up in a rope and, you know, fallen into the Arctic Ocean, which is not a good thing. Eventually, one of our colleagues had to cut her rope so that that wouldn't happen. They then picked up her, this woman, Sinny from Finland, and the other climber, who's a chap called Marco from Switzerland, and they took them. They just kind of took them. I mean, they didn't arrest them or charge them or anything. They just took them away. So we didn't know what had happened to them or hear from them again until the following day, at which point the Arctic Sunrise, which is our ship, was in international waters, which had actually been the whole time in international waters, and a helicopter started hovering above it, and about 15 of these masked, jackbooted fellas with several guns and knives rappelled onto the ship. There are some cell phone photos that some of the crew were able to take before they were taken, which shows most of the crew on their knees, their hands up on the helipad at gunpoint at the end of these automatic weapons. They then tried to get the captain, who was an American and a bit of a legend, Captain Peter Wilcox. He's been a Greenpeace captain for more than 30 years. He was actually the captain of the Rainbow Warrior, the first Rainbow Warrior, when it was in Auckland in 1985, when it was bombed by the French government, which killed one of our photographers. So he's been through some pretty hairy times with Greenpeace, but I suspect this might take the cake. And he, at gunpoint, refused to sail the ship because he said it was an illegal boarding, and as captain he shouldn't have to do that, in fact wouldn't do that. So the Russians were forced to tow the ship back to Murmansk, which is a port city there in the Arctic, which took over 100 hours. And during that time, they were pretty much incommunicado. There was no contact made with us or the lawyers or the diplomats or anything. And when they reached Murmansk, they took everyone to court. And they do have this fairly awful kind of brutal habit of putting people in these giant cages in the courtroom. And they went through one by one. It took them several days. And they charged everyone with piracy, which was pretty bizarre, quite a shock. And we thought initially, we thought such a bizarre overreaction that it would soon be sorted out, because every maritime expert, even people who don't have the time of day for Greenpeace or our tactics or our mission, every legal academic, you know, independent lawyers all around the world, as well as on about day three, Vladimir Putin himself said that it was ridiculous, that we clearly, obviously was the word he used, obviously weren't pirates.
So the Russian government recently said that they were going to withdraw the piracy charge and replace them with lesser charges of hooliganism, but that's not the case, is it, Keeler?
No, it's kind of complicated. There's two or three parts to the hooliganism law in Russian legal code, and there's also various degrees of seriousness, but one of the key underlying elements of a hooliganism charge is that it has to be brought generally against those either using weapons or violence to violate public order. It's generally supposed to be used on the grounds of hatred for particular race or ethnicity or social group, and that has to cause civil unrest. So obviously we would argue very strongly, as many have, that those, while the piracy charges were absurd, the hooliganism charges are also absolutely baseless.
So Amnesty International has gotten involved, Desmond Tutu, Hillary Clinton you mentioned, but has the Obama administration themselves weighed in on this issue?
They haven't exactly weighed in. They have been involved. The State Department has been involved since the very beginning. Certainly nothing public and nothing very strong. Part of the concern about that is that for many in Russia, the Russian state media has been repeating fervently since the very beginning, and actually since long before that, that Greenpeace is an arm of the American state that is there to destroy Russian sovereignty. I mean, Arctic oil is... oil and gas is about half that country's budget, and Arctic oil is going to be an enormous financial boon to them. So, you know, they're very, very keen to protect that income stream. And a lot of people have been told, a lot of Russians are told on a daily basis that this is sort of an act of aggression by a foreign government, despite the fact that Greenpeace was actually started in Canada, and despite the fact that we have a 42-year history of nonviolent civil disobedience against all sorts of government and all sorts of corporations from all over the world.
In your opinion, Keeler, do you think this will help the international global climate movement in the end? Often repressive actions like this can often end with a backlash.
I don't know about how much it'll help the climate movement, but I do think that it has been very heartening to see thousands and thousands and thousands of people, both in comments and feedback and in the pub, say, you know, I'm not really sure about Greenpeace, or I'm not really a greenie, but what's going on in Russia is absurd and disgraceful. And so I think in some ways, yes, it's certainly put the issue out there. And it's also taking a very hard look at some of the terrible human rights abuses in Russia.
Speaking of that, has Greenpeace and their families heard from the Arctic 30, and are they okay, to the best of your knowledge?
They are allowed only a certain number of letters in and out, but in the last couple of weeks, they've managed to get more letters, not many, but more letters, which are, of course, heavily censored, to their family and friends. And some of those family and friends have then taken them to the media. So we are hearing like first-person reports now of what it's like and how they're feeling. This could drag on for years. And then, of course, if they are sentenced, they could face a custodial sentence of years. So are they okay? I think they're doing amazingly well in the circumstances. I can't imagine how I would be going.
Well, we certainly are thinking of your colleagues and wish them a speedy release. And it's admirable, all the work that so many of you are doing to expedite their release. Media officer from Greenpeace, Keeler McDuff. Keeler, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Great talking to you.
Come down on your own and leave your body alone. Somebody has to change. You are the reason.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
Next, we're joined by Gareth McKinley, who's a professor of mechanical engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. Gareth, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
Why don't you tell us about this fog harvesting project that you and some MIT students and another professor have been involved in, not only in this country, but also in Chile.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So a couple of years ago, MIT announced a program called MISTI, which is a student exchange program that's designed to connect students and faculty members at MIT with other universities around the world. And one of the programs was with Chile, and in particular with a university called the Pontifical University of Chile in Santiago. And some colleagues there, Professor Juan de Dios and Professor Pilar Ceredada, reached out to us and had seen some of our work on how to coat surfaces to improve how liquids run off the surfaces. And they have spent a number of years working on fog harvesting, and they felt that some of these coatings might be something that was very useful to improve what you might call the efficiency, or how much water can you get off a fog harvester per unit time.
And can you walk us back just a little bit and give us a brief snapshot of the history of fog collecting?
Certainly. Fog collecting has actually been known really since prehistoric times. And anybody who's been into the basement of a large stone building will know that frequently the walls feel moist, and condensation and droplets will run down those cold walls. Typically, what you're familiar with there is actually the process of what some people would think of as dew condensation, or the formation of dew in the morning. The difference with fog is that fog is already liquid droplets. So when you see a fog cloud, or when a cloud blows in with fog, nature has already done the condensation for you. And in particular, actually, nature has really done all of the hard work for you. The power from the sun has actually evaporated the water, and it turns out to be drinkable water or potable water. Most of the impurities are left behind, and nature's already done the work of condensing the droplets. So all you really have to do is collect them and run them down a surface into a trough, and collect them, and you have drinkable water, essentially with no power input.
But now let's fast forward from prehistoric times to the last decade or two. There's been lots of different generations in the materials that are used to capture and or harvest this fog, correct?
Correct. And the colleagues in Chile have actually been some of the leaders in this area. And there's actually a non-governmental organization or an NGO in Canada called FogQuest that actually has pioneered the development of a standard test methodology for understanding this. What makes life complicated is that fog is different in different places around the world. And anyone who's been in the Bay Area knows that fog changes with time of year, with the strength of the wind. And so comparing numbers from one place to another has always been very difficult. Now, colleagues in Chile have developed a test protocol for understanding that. And in the 1990s, they actually developed some fog harvesters that actually were used to supply all of the water needs of a couple of remote villages up in the Atacama Desert. So up there, there are some places where it's literally never rained since people have started collecting records. And so the challenge is, how can I get some water there without either pumping it in or building a very expensive desalination facility?
And the numbers are pretty striking, right? The Chilean investigators, I'm reading here from an article that's describing the paper, that if just 4% of the water contained in the fog could be captured, that would be sufficient to meet all of the water needs of this region in Chile.
That's correct. Yes, the further north you go in Chile, the more arid it gets. And with mining, there's very large copper mines there. The water needs have certainly become something that's become a very big challenge, as it has in parts of the desert southwest in the U.S. as well. So there's a tension between the government and the mining industry and the local indigenous population. So there's plenty of fog there. The challenge is how to collect it and how to collect it in the most efficient way. And that's really what we focused on, is not building a new fog harvester, but in understanding the fundamental physics of what the processes are that go on when you try and collect fog.
Now, is that 4% number a feasible number to reach? What are the usual thresholds, and how efficient has fog harvesting been in the past? And with this new innovation, how efficient can it be?
So a typical fog collector that might be installed up in the mountains there at the moment typically collects somewhere between 2% and 4% of the water that's coming towards it. And the way to understand that is that you have to build a porous or a system with holes in it, because it's really a mesh. And as the wind blows towards it, if you have a solid wall, then the wind will blow around it and none of the droplets will actually hit the mesh. So you have to have holes in it. If you have holes in it, then some of the water goes right through. Some of the water will hit the mesh and will stick on the mesh, and it's a bit like a wet sail or a wet piece of cloth. You collect water, but it doesn't drain out of the mesh. And then the sun comes up later on in the morning, it gets hot, and a lot of the water evaporates. And so all of those are inefficiencies that reduce the amount of water you might be able to collect. So what we did in this paper was analyze the fluid mechanics of that process. So you have little droplets coming in, borne by the wind. They hit the mesh. They coalesce into larger droplets. And then what you want is you want them to run down the mesh and be collected. And what we showed, based on some theory and then on some experiments in the lab here, is that we can probably increase that to somewhere around about 10, maybe 12% collection efficiency. So that's more than a factor of 2, maybe as large as a factor of 5 larger than existing meshes.
And this is by spacing the holes and having the holes the correct size more than overhauling the mesh that is used, because this is a polyolefin mesh, right, which is pretty common plastic.
Yes, yeah, polyolefin is probably the most common and cheapest plastic around. So polypropylene and polyethylene are both examples of polyolefins. That means that they're relatively cheap to make, but what people have not done is think about the size of the holes and the size of the mesh compared to the size of a raindrop or a fog droplet. And the key thing, I think we're all probably familiar with seeing droplets of dew collected on very thin fibers, say maybe a spider web. And what you can see there is that the spider web is made of very, very thin fibers compared to the size of a typical mesh. And by doing some analysis, we show that in fact what you want to do is you want to have lots more finer fibers or thinner fibers. That turns out to be much more efficient than having a few thick fibers.
Oh, I can now hear the sailors cry, smell the sea and feel the sky. Let your soul and spirit fly into the mystic. And where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. Yeah, when the foghorn blows, I wanna hear it. I don't have to fear it, and I wanna rock your gypsy soul. Just like way back in the days of old. Yeah, magnificently we will fold into the mystic.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Gareth McKinley. I know this is radio, but can you kind of paint a visual picture for us on how the mesh or the harvester would be, what size and what angles, and then how the water gets funneled out of that?
Absolutely. Let's see if I can do the best I can to describe that. So what we studied was a series of meshes, or a family of meshes that are all what you might think of as the same style. They're basically a simple woven mesh. And what we did is vary the spacing of the holes and vary the thickness of the fibers. So that's slightly different than if you were to go to a mountainside and look at a fog harvester now. They tend to have a more complicated mesh design. We tried to simplify it so that we could do some analysis. And then the other important part is you have to think about the wind speed and the size of the droplets, and then what we would call the kinetic energy of the incoming droplets. So that's something that we're all familiar with when we think about cycling, maybe, that small droplets will actually deflect with the airstream and go round our face, but something with a lot of inertia, let's say a bug or something like that, will actually not get deflected by the airstream and actually will impact our face. And that's exactly the same physics as we sought to understand. So big droplets have a lot of inertia. They tend to hit the mesh. They stick to the mesh. And if you're just dealing with a normal mesh, then they will just stick there. They'll just stay there. But what you want is you want them to run down the mesh under gravity. So you want them to drain down the mesh and collect at the bottom. And so what we showed is that by changing the coating on the mesh, you can actually improve that process. And it's very similar to the process that you might think about if you've ever put Rain-X on your window. What it is that prevents droplets of rain from running down your window is a chemical process or a chemical property called the contact angle hysteresis. That's kind of a complicated way of saying that droplets like to get stuck on surfaces and don't run off very easily. But by changing the coating, you can actually make droplets run down more easily. And so what we showed is that putting the right kind of coating on the right kind of mesh with the right kind of holes, the droplets will hit the surface, they'll collect into bigger droplets, they'll drain under gravity into basically a trough at the bottom, and then you can collect that and you can drink it.
Do you foresee this being a technology which is scalable to urban areas, or is this really just for more arid, rural, agricultural-based regions of the planet?
Yes, I think at the moment, it's probably best designed for very remote locations and arid regions where it's very hard to build the infrastructure to supply water. One of the nice things is that you tend to collect water on hillsides at elevation. And so by collecting it in a pond at the top of the hill, you actually already have some gravitational potential energy or pressure head so that you actually don't have to pressurize the system. So you just have to build the fog collectors, collect the water, and you've already got a system that's got some driving force available to it. I think it's a very scalable technology. Really, the main cost is the initial capital investment.
And that was my next question. How capital intensive are these kind of fog harvesting technologies? Obviously, they'll benefit from economies of scale when they become more prevalent, or if they become more prevalent. But what kind of entry point are we looking at right now?
Yes, indeed. I think it's a very scalable. In other words, the cost for a small installation isn't very big. So it's much smaller than, say, the capital cost required for plumbing and piping. And then, of course, it's directly proportional to the number that are deployed or the size of the fog harvester that is deployed. My colleagues in Chile are actually building one of the largest fog harvesting installations in the world at the moment, and in an area called Peña Blanca, where they're actually building one that's 40 times as big as the 1 square meter ones that we studied. And I think a good analogy here is to think about the difference between the farmstead with a small windmill that was designed for remote operation if you just wanted to pump water out of the ground or generate a little electricity, and the very large installations that you might see in, say, a modern wind farm. It's basically the same technology. You need a much larger capital investment initially, but then once installed, you've got this large installed base that you can collect, in our case, fog, for many, many years. And so I think that with the right governmental driving force or the right pressure on water needs, that you will see in the future much larger and much more efficient installations being developed. And we're really at the very beginning, kind of 100 years ago, what a windmill is and what a wind farm is today, same technology, just clearly optimized with new materials and higher efficiency. And what we focused on really is that efficiency part of it.
And Gareth, do you foresee a day when that fog harvesting becomes so prevalent that it can be used on even smaller scales, so people in their home gardens and in more populated regions may be able to, they may have access to water, but they don't want to waste water. So is this a potentially good way to conserve as well?
I think potentially it is. And my colleagues in Chile are actually have had a number of student design projects where they've looked at small garden scale installations. In the Canary Islands, there's actually a company that's developing a very scalable technology that indeed you could think about putting one of them in your backyard, and it might be suitable for collecting water, maybe for irrigating or growing plants. In Chile, they've looked at growing agave and various other kinds of desert plants using the water that they collect. So I think it's certainly possible that in the future you might see individual families or farmsteads putting a fog harvester in.
Gareth McKinley, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Leroy Hudson, Bonnie Raitt, and Van Morrison. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.